Welcome to NGA Notable Lectures, a podcast offering a deeper understanding of all things artistic. David Smith is arguably America's greatest sculptor of the 20th century. His art enlarged the vocabulary of sculpture by employing welding and industrial processes and materials, laying the groundwork for the directness of minimalism and the realization that sculpture could be anything the artist desired. Smith's oeuvre is a logical outgrowth of earlier 20th century sculptural trends in cubism, constructivism, and surrealism. However, his work also represents a new paradigm for the language of modern sculpture that reflects the dynamic growth and industrial prowess of the United States after the Second World War. Smith's confrontation with the process of creation broke the rules and expanded the possibilities of his art form. In part one of this lecture, presented at the National Gallery of Art on March 7, 2019, senior lecturer David Gariff explores Smith's revolutionary art through a discussion of some of his most important and innovative works, including the Agricola, Tank Totem, Sentinel, Zig, Voltri, and Cubi series.
So welcome to the National Gallery. My name is David Gariff. I'm a senior lecturer here. And I've been talking about David Smith for the last couple of weeks. And I was giving, a short little gallery talk in the galleries about one of the sculptures by Smith that you'll also see today. But David Smith deserves much more than that. And so I decided to do an entire lecture covering his entire career. And that's what you're attending today. This is a photograph of David Smith at his studio home in Bolton Landing, which is in upstate New York near Lake George. This is a photograph from 1962. He had 85 acres of land there, and he, through the course of his life, populated the landscape with his sculptures. So you can see some of those sculptures that he's sitting here looking out at. We'll come back to that in a second. There are a lot of different approaches to David Smith. Much has been written about David Smith. There are certain general ideas that everybody sort of talks about. One I've just mentioned, the importance of welding and working in now a new material, which is steel. His work has a huge impact, especially the very last series that he produces, which is the Cubi series, these big works in stainless steel. Those works will have a huge impact on the later history of 20th century sculpture, especially in going into minimalism and the works of other sculptors. He is a sculptor who looks backwards, and he's very much a student of art history. He was aware of trends in sculpture going back to Egypt, the ancient Greeks, the Romans, medieval art, all the way up to the present day. He was aware of early 20th century movements that certainly affected him, most notably Cubism, Constructivism, and Surrealism. These three movements were the movements that he sort of emerged from, you might say, or even in the realm of being a welder, although he had practical experience welding in factories, where he welded in a Studebaker factory and also in a locomotive factory. He realized in 1928, when he saw an article in the French art journal Cahiers d'Art, and he saw it was an article written about the welded sculptures of Picasso and Julio Gonzalez, he realized that, well, maybe I don't just have to weld locomotives. Maybe this is a technique for art. And so that was certainly an inspiration. We'll talk more about that in its appropriate place. Another reason I've chosen to discuss David Smith at this moment in time is because, as I think most of you know, the East Building was closed for 3 years, and we renovated it, and we reinstalled the entire collection in the East Building from ground level all the way up. And to sort of celebrate that reopening, we were fortunate enough to get sort of gifts to the permanent collection that are now here on extended loan. They're not works that we own. They're not in our permanent collection. But because certain foundations and estates wanted to sort of celebrate what we had accomplished, They've loaned us pieces for extended loan. The biggest and most important loan was Alexander Calder. So today, when you go to the top, the sculpture terrace, there's a whole tower gallery devoted to Calder. And many of those works are on long extended loan from the Calder Foundation. So they're works that we technically don't own. You won't find them on the website. That was similar with David Smith. The David Smith estate has loaned us three works. They're the first three that you see here. Blue Construction from 38, Aggressive Character from 47, and Black White Forward from 61. Blue Construction and Aggressive Character are in the upper level of the in the room with the Abstract Expressionist painters. And the little gallery talk I was giving, the 30-minute talk last couple of weeks, was on Aggressive Character. That's a small sculpture. This sculpture is in the atrium of the East Building, right near the information desk. So that's where that's located. And this last sculpture that is not from the David Smith estate, this was loaned to us from the Kafritz Foundation. It's Cubi 11 from 1963. This was loaned to us a while back. It used to be in our sculpture garden. That's that photograph there. But it's no longer in the sculpture garden. We've moved it upstairs to the terrace, or to the sculpture terrace in the East Building. So these four works now supplement and complement the works of David Smith that we do have in our permanent collection, and we do have some of his most important works as part of our permanent collection. So approaching David Smith, I think there are three or four points to keep in mind when you try to situate him. Certainly one is what I've sort of already alluded to. He is in some ways a logical outgrowth of earlier movements in the 20th century, and most specifically the three I've already mentioned, Cubism, Constructivism, and Surrealism. Secondly, the point that's often made, and sometimes this is very much foregrounded, is that this choice of working in welded steel was sort of symptomatic of the dynamic growth of the United States after the Second World War, when we were seen as this industrial power. And so the whole idea of industry, factories, the sort of roaring economy, all of these things, and that his art sort of was almost a symbol of that kind of idea. There's truth to that. A third point to keep in mind, again, I've sort of just alluded to, here's a sculptor who certainly knew the history of art and the history of sculpture. He was incredibly well-read, attended museums, all of this, and in fact, his interest in sculpture went all the way back to the Egyptians. So especially the Egyptians, the Greeks, the Etruscans, and the Romans were sculptural periods he was particularly interested in. He would come to sign his works of art by his initials in Greek. So Delta Sigma would be his initials, the way he would sign works for DS, for David Smith. The fourth thing I would mention, and this is in keeping with concerns throughout the 20th century, he was very much concerned with the process of art, the actual art or an act of making things. And the result of it, he very often embraced chance and the accident, things that would happen that he hadn't anticipated. So in that sense, he was very much about breaking a lot of the rules, trying things. Sometimes they worked, sometimes they didn't. So all of that is a good foregrounding. And the other thing to keep in mind is certainly this love of steel or iron. So here's a quote from David Smith. The material called iron or steel I hold in high respect. What it can do in arriving at form economically, no other material can do. The metal itself possesses little art history. What associations it possesses are those of this century. Power, structure, movement, progress, suspension, destruction, and brutality. All of those terms are great at describing Smith's sculpture. And when he says it possesses little art history, he feels liberated by that, because you can't really look back and see how Michelangelo welded steel. So he doesn't have to worry about a lot of that, because his methods, materials are essentially new in 20th century. There's another aspect of Smith that's very important, and that is how he saw himself. And he saw himself as a laborer, and he was a welder in the traditional sense of I go to work, I go to a factory, and I weld all day. This is a photograph of Smith in his welding gear here in 1935. I'm showing you work on the right that I'm not going to talk about because we could spend literally 3 hours on it. But it's very important, so you might want to look this up on your own. This is a small work called the Home of the Welder, or the House of the Welder, from 1945. This still belongs to the Smith estate, although it travels a lot. It was recently at the Tate in London. I bring it in here because that is probably, maybe arguably, the most autobiographical sculpture that Smith creates. Every little part of that sculpture, every little thing that's in that sculpture is a commentary on his life, on his beliefs, on his situation. In part, it sort of deals with the conflict between his desire to be an artist and his domestic life, and how that was a conflict because he had to earn a living, and yet he wanted to be an artist. And so that's a big conflict for him. There's an art historian, Edward Fry, who's written on David Smith. And he gives, I think, the best description of this sculpture. He calls it, quote, one of the greatest examples of auto-psychoanalysis in the history of modern art. And it is. It's filled with, once you know David Smith, you can pluck out certain things that are sort of giving us a hint to his ideas about his life. But this emphasis on being a worker, a laborer, Smith's politics were certainly on the left. And he was very sympathetic to labor unions, to the labor movement. He literally belonged to the union, the Steelworkers Union. He belonged to Local 2054, and he was very proud of that. So talking about some of this, he said at different times, quote, I know workmen, I know their vision, because between college years I worked on Studebaker's production line and later on ship repair in Brooklyn Harbor. Therefore, I know what my art must be to reach them, to reach the working class. Then he says in a different time, this is in the 40s, he says, by choice, I identify myself with working men and still belong to Local 2054, United Steelworkers of America. I belong by craft, yet my subject of aesthetics introduces a breach. I suppose that it is because I believe in a working man's society in the future that and in that society, I hope to find a place. In this society, I find little place to identify myself economically. So in the 30s and the 40s, of course, he feels more aligned to the cause of workers, to the labor movement. And the idea of, well, can't put it any other way, capitalism, and the destructive aspects of capitalism is something that he's sort of chafing at. Now, he's not alone. In the 30s in America, so many sculptors were part of this left movement, most especially Stuart Davis, who founded the Artists Union. All these artists were a member, almost all these artists were a member of the American, the Congress of American Artists, which was a leftist organization. And David Smith, for a brief time, late in the 30s, joined the Communist Party. A number of artists joined the Communist Party at this time. In the late 30s, because it seemed like it was only the communists who were fighting fascism, most especially during the Spanish Civil War from 1936 to 39. So there was that leftist bent in Smith as well as in his peers. And here are his peers on the left. But this photograph, which is one of the most famous photographs of the New York School, appeared in Life magazine in 1951. And it was titled The Irascibles, because they had already kind of developed this reputation of being rather difficult. These were his friends. These were his peers. These were his colleagues. He's not in that photograph, probably only because he wasn't in New York City when it was taken. He was probably in Bolton Landing in upstate New York. So here's Jackson Pollock. Here's Mark Rothko. Here's Willem de Kooning. But most importantly, of the group of the New York School artists, the artist who was his closest friend throughout his entire life, and who will become, in fact, one of the executors of his estate after his death, is Robert Motherwell. Motherwell and Motherwell's eventual wife, Helen Frankenthaler, the three of these artists, Frankenthaler, Smith, and Motherwell, will have a relationship and a friendship that will last all the way up until David Smith's rather tragic demise. That's David Smith on the right at Bolton Landing in 1958. So Smith, in the 50s, he talked about his earlier experiences in New York City back in the 30s, and he said, quote, "One did not feel disowned, only ignored, and much alone, with a vague pressure from authority that art couldn't be made here. It was a time of temporary expatriates, not that they made art more in France, but that they talked it, and when here they were happier, and not that their concept was more avant-garde than ours, but they were under its shadow there, and we were in the windy openness here." So he's contrasting living in New York with living in Paris, and the contrast between the American artists, who only would slowly begin to go to Europe, and some never did, and the Americans, and what you could do in New York, and what was happening in Paris. Now, here's a photograph, again, kind of a family photo in some ways, showing Smith with his friends from the New York School. This is Lee Krasner. This is Smith's second wife, Jean Frias. This is Jackson Pollock. This is Smith. This is Clement Greenberg. And this is Helen Frankenthaler. And this is a photograph taken at Bolton Landing in 1951. On the right is David Smith with a sculpture from 51 called Australia. It's one of these open sort of drawing in space sculptures that we'll be talking about that concept. He did come up with this phrase, although actually Julio Gonzalez used the same phrase, drawing in space, that he thought he was sort of drawing in space, but of course they're not drawings, they're metal, welded sculptures. But he said at the time, quote, "I do not recognize the limits where painting ends and sculpture begins." This work has been discussed in a lot of different ways. Some people believe the title comes from the fact that it looks kind of like a jumping kangaroo. That's why he titled it Australia. There was a letter and a note that was exchanged. Greenberg had been looking at Aboriginal Australian cave drawings and rock petroglyphs and things. And there was one of a warrior. And then he said, "The one of the warrior reminds me particularly of some of your sculptures." So for Greenberg, looking at the sculpture, he thought the title might refer to Aboriginal art in Australia. The other connection that's been made often is between David Smith and James Joyce. Smith was particularly interested in Finnegan's Wake, and a number of the abstract expressionists were fascinated with that book. I truly don't believe anybody read it. the whole way through. I've never been able to. Maybe you have. I've given it a go. But what they were interested in was the idea of Joyce creating a new language, a new syntax. And they found that sort of comparable in some ways to their own endeavors. Here is David Smith on the left being hugged by Helen Frankenthaler. And this is a photograph from 1957. Do you know what they're seated in front of? It's the painting we have upstairs. It's Helen Frankenthaler's Mountains and Sea, arguably her most important painting. So that's the painting. Here's Frankenthaler, here's Smith. On the right is Frankenthaler with Robert Motherwell on their wedding day. They had a wedding lunch reception. They got married on April 6, 1958. So it was Greenberg, in fact, who had introduced Frankenthaler to David Smith. So he was the kind of go-between. And that was this relationship among the three of them, Smith, Motherwell, and Frankenthaler, as I said, would last Smith's entire life. Here's David Smith in Bolton Landing in 58. And on the right, this is Motherwell, Frankenthaler, and Smith at Bolton Landing in 62. Smith is born in Decatur, Indiana, in 1906. His mother was a school teacher. His father was a telephone engineer. He was a part-time inventor, and his father loved machinery, and he kind of passed that interest on to his son. They say that when David Smith was 3 or 4 or 5, he used to disassemble phones. He would just unscrew everything and take it all apart, and then sometimes he couldn't get it back together again. the family moved to Ohio in 1921 to Paulding, Ohio. Smith took a correspondence course in drawing from the Cleveland Art School, which is today the CIA, the Cleveland Institute of Art. He then went ahead and enrolled in Ohio University in Athens. He only spent a year there, and then he dropped out. He did spend a brief stint at Notre Dame. He went back to Indiana and enrolled at Notre Dame, but he realized they didn't really have an art department. So then he moved actually to D.C. He worked in a bank here. He got a job in a bank, and he studied poetry at GW while he was in Washington. He worked all of his summers, though, as a riveter and a welder to earn money. So he worked at a Studebaker factory, worked at a locomotive plant, and then he decided to move to New York. So he moves to New York in 1926, and he enrolls at the Art Students League. He's only there for about a year, but he meets his wife there. He meets his first wife, Dorothy Denner, a very important painter, sculptor in her own right. He meets her at the Art Students League. They marry in 27, and they move to Brooklyn, and they really don't have a lot of money. So they're looking for an apartment, but Smith also wants some kind of a studio. And so what he ends up finding is he goes to an actual commercial welding factory, and it has a name. It was called Terminal Ironworks. And he just asks the welders if he could have a little corner of their space. Can I take a little space in your factory? And they said fine. So he starts to think about art and being an artist and a sculptor while in this factory. Should mention something about the Art Students League. He studied mainly painting. His first interest was painting. And when he is at the Art Students League, the painter professor that he studies with was very important to him, and that's the Czech artist Jan Matulka. Matulka was very important in introducing Smith to abstraction, to all of the major movements in European painting of the 20th century. As I said, he gets married in 27. He moves into this small apartment that is adjoining or close to, here you can just see barely the sign, Terminal Ironworks, takes over a little corner of this space. He doesn't have a lot of space, so he has to work small. And these are all very early small sculptures by David Smith. You don't need to know all of them, but I'm going to tell you what they are anyway. We can identify all of them. It's the one on the ground is Unidentified Sculpture, then Bent Blade Construction from 36, Construction in Bent Planes from 36, Sculptor and Model from 37, which in fact in this photograph is unfinished. So all of these sculptures date from 1936. He has access to the scrap heaps in the Terminal Ironworks, so he can pick out pieces of metal and things that he can use to make sculptures. Now, at the same time, his wife did have an income of $2,000 a year that was based on some land holdings that her family had. And there was a kind of dividend, I guess, that was related to that. So that's when they decided to try to find another place to live, but they wanted to be out of the city. So they went north up the Hudson, and that's when they discovered Bolton Landing on Lake George. And at that time, the only thing that was on that land was a dilapidated house and barn. But it was sitting on, they bought 85 acres of land. That's how cheap the land was, around the house and barn. And then that would be his, for a long time, they split their time. Every summer they would go to Bolton Landing to try to renovate the house and everything. And eventually they would move there permanently around 1940. Now, Smith lived through and was aware of all of these traumas that America sort of went through. World War I, the Great Depression, the rise of fascism, World War II, the post-war emergence of America after the wars. And so clearly his art reflects much of that, especially in its politics. In the fall of 35, he goes to Europe. They go first to Paris, but then they travel widely. They go to Italy. They go throughout all Western Europe. They go into the Soviet Union. They visit the Soviet Union. And then they go to Greece as well. And he stays in Greece and actually, for a number of months, has a little studio in Greece. And he studies at the American School of Classical Studies in Greece, in Athens. And in fact, he even asked the Greek government if he could have permission to take scrapings of color off of Greek sculptures. He knew they had all been painted originally. And he was already thinking about the relationship between color and sculpture. He comes back to New York in 36. Of course, the most important movement in the between the First and Second World War in Europe was Surrealism. This is the cover of the first Surrealist Revolution journal, where Breton's manifesto was published. This is 1924, and then a photograph of the Surrealists, some of them together on the right. Surrealism would play an important role in Smith's early sort of development. I mentioned by this time they're kind of going back and forth. Here is, if I'm going to take the exit, it's exit 24, off the New York State Thruway. So there you see where it is up here, north of Albany. And there's the photograph I already showed you in the introduction. Surrealism would be very important to David Smith, and it would be reflected in his very first important series. Now, I say series, because David Smith did tend to work in series, but you have to be very careful about that when you say that. It's not that he did a number of works and then this series is over, and now I'm starting a new series, and he never goes back to this other series. That's not like that. There's a lot of bleeding and blurred boundaries. There are a lot of works that are not technically part of a series, but if you look at them, you would certainly say it's a cousin to the series. The best example, at one of the best, would be Black White Forward that we have. That really could fit into the series called the Zig, Z-I-G, the Zig series. It speaks the same language. Having said that, these are some of his most important series and the chronology that we follow. So there's Medals for Dishonor, 39-40. Then we have the Five Specters. The steel drawings are these sort of drawings in space that we've mentioned already. The Agricola series, the Tank Totem series, the Forgings, the Sentinel series, which has two different stops and starts. The Sentinel series is begun in 56 till 57, then he stops, then he revisits it in 61, but this time he changes the material from iron and steel to stainless steel. The Zig series, the Voltry series, the Circle series, Voltry-Bolton series, the Wagons, and the Cubi series, his greatest series. That's the one that really has the most impact on later sculptors. That takes him up to his death. The Cubi series has 28 sculptures in it. Takes him up to his death, and he dies, of course, tragically in a car crash on May 23rd, 1965. Now, I mentioned Surrealism. And one of the things that was influencing David Smith among the Surrealists, Surrealist sculpture has an interesting history because to a large extent it's not sculpture. It was the so-called Surrealist object. And the Surrealist object was about putting strange things together to make some kind of weird statement. For example, Salvatore Dali putting the lobster on the telephone, right? So you're talking into the lobster. The great Joan Miró sculpture where he has a parrot, a stuffed parrot on a kind of beautifully wooden carved sort of, looks like a little bit of like a tree, that's resting on a bowler hat. Those are Surrealist objects. The sculptor that Smith was most interested in was not the sculptors who were object makers. He was interested in Giacometti. And Giacometti continued to do traditional things with materials. And specifically, in his case, he would cast bronze. And he was not just interested in Giacometti from that point of view, the materials, but he was interested in Giacometti's themes. Because Giacometti was a Surrealist. Eventually, he gets kicked out of Surrealism by Breton. That's another story. Part of Surrealism was imagery that dealt with hostility, aggression, violence. And unfortunately, especially today, when we talk about this, it was often violence between men and women. It was images of rape and things of this nature. Smith had a similar sense of this hostility that Giacometti did. So in this sculpture, this is Giacometti's Man and Woman from 1928-29, where you see, obviously, I don't have to analyze this for you, this sort of male shape, this female shape, and this sort of aggressive connection But this was tame compared to this sculpture by Giacometti, Woman with Her Throat Cut, from 1932. That's at MoMA today. This is one of, I mean, this is a pure image of sexuality and violence and violent sexuality. It, when you see it, and the way you're supposed to see it, Giacometti wanted it seen on the floor, so you should stand above it like you see those people on the right. When you do that, it literally does look like a crime scene. This figure has been dismembered, has had her jugular vein cut. There are all kinds of body parts that refer to all kinds of different forms. Part of it looks like it's an insect, like it's a reptile. It's pretty tough in many ways. It has this form that looks like a straight razor. That's the sort of the weapon that's been used here. But this is less a surrealist object than it is a surrealist sculpture. But what it taps into is what, for Giacometti, was very important, the Freudian aspects of surrealism, the dreams we have, some of which can be very horrific dreams, where we're dealing with things deep in our subconscious that we don't want to deal with in everyday reality. Smith believed in that kind of imagery and that kind of approach. So the violence of Giacometti is especially relevant to the first series of works that Smith does, which are the medals for dishonor that you see here. This is the catalog on the left that Smith designed. That's his drawing. And he wrote the text. There are 15 medals in this series. Today they're on extended loan in Madrid, and this is how they're displayed in Madrid in this case here. Smith talked about this series after the fact. This dates 39-40, but in 42 he said, quote, "This series hit the dishonorable and destructive elements of society. Certain elements, though true, might be interpreted as conflicting with war effort. One fact I wish to restate, that my basic conception has always been anti-fascist and pro-democratic." So he sees these images as images speaking to the atrocities of war. And each title in the series sort of reflects that, because here are the titles of the 15 medals. So the first is Propaganda for War, the Fourth Estate, Munition Makers. These are the people who benefit by being able to sell their munitions. Diplomats, who of course are unreliable and make false peace efforts, etc. Private Law and Order Leagues. There was already the German Bund in the United States that was talking about the rise of Nazism, but he's also thinking about groups like the Ku Klux Klan. War-exempt sons of the rich. If you're rich, you have bone spurs, you don't have to go to war. Cooperation of the clergy. They can often be complicit in these other things. Death by gas, bombing the civilian populations, and you can see the rest. Sinking hospital and rescue ships, death by bacteria, reaction in medicine, elements which cause prostitution, food trust, scientific disposal. So these medals are anti-war, they're anti-capitalist, and they're anti-fascist. And they reveal more than anything probably David Smith's politics at this point in time. They are a very angry denunciation of the atrocities of war. For his imagery, he didn't just rely on Giacometti, but he went back further. He looked at Goya, the disasters of war. He looked at Hieronymus Bosch. He looked at Peter Bruegel. These were all sources for the surrealists in general. Here's the first medal, Propaganda for War. And this is the catalog. Again, it was designed, the catalog was designed by Smith, and he wrote the entries. This shows this whole kind of, this woman on the bull here trumpeting, sort of rousing people that this is a war that has to be fought, going back to the Wilsonian ideas and the First World War, the war to end all wars, the war to make the world safe for democracy, all this jingoism that comes about during war. He has an inscription here and here. His inscriptions are in Greek. One is the title itself, Propaganda for War. Another is the word blacksmith. He thinks of himself as a blacksmith in many ways. And at Bolton Landing, he installs a forge and an anvil. And he will be a traditional blacksmith in that regard. And then he signs the work in Greek with his Greek letters. This imagery, this cannon up here, and this woman reclining, a lot of this comes right out of Giacometti. Here's the Fourth Estate on the left, and bombing civilian populations on the right. the manipulation of truth, the manipulation of the press, the free press that should be maintained, but often itself is culpable in sort of promoting war and trying to bring the population along with that idea, bombing the civilian population. This is a high chair for a child, and a big bomb is sitting in it. And so the destruction of the innocence of people who are not soldiers, they're not in the war, they're the so-called collateral damage, children, the elderly, etc. Now, what's interesting, these medals date 39 to 40. Just months after his exhibition of these medals, there was an exhibition that the medals were being exhibited in 39, late 39 to 40. There was an exhibition that opened up in the United States, and it was on Picasso. It opened up in November of 1939, and the title of the exhibition was Picasso, 40 Years of His Art, and included, and what that exhibition was essentially about was this painting, which was on tour throughout the United States. So Smith knew Guernica, and this exhibition had both the painting, the actual painting, which is quite large, and over 100 preparatory sketches and drawings by Picasso. So clearly, Guernica, in addition to surrealism, the Bosch, Bruegel, Goya, the imagery of Guernica was very important to the medals. And it was, of course, Picasso's own statement about the atrocities of the Spanish Civil War, the strifing and destruction of Guernica by Franco, but Franco using German machinery, German Stuka dive bombers. In other words, Hitler was happy to test out all of his machinery, giving it to Franco so that, because he knew he himself was going to be taking Germany towards war. You know, there was that famous, I don't want to get off on tangents, but during the war, Picasso stayed in Paris during the occupation. And he just figured, hell, I'm Picasso, what are they going to do? And the Nazis were very concerned about him. And so one day they came and they had this picture of Guernica. And they said, did you do this? And he said, no, you did. So that was sort of the way it went. David Smith wrote about the bombing of Guernica in 1950. Looking back, he said, the bombing of Guernica didn't surprise me too much. I thought it was pretty much capitalist perfidy, especially the way the blockade went. I had gone to Europe in 1935 to see it before I expected it to be bombed out. He had actually gone to this village. I was very saddened at the fall of Spain, but I had also witnessed the invasion of Ethiopia by fascism and was fully aware of the Nazi penetration of Greece when I was there. So this is, again, coming out of his own experiences. Now, one of the things that's always mentioned, getting back more less to politics and more to aesthetics here, is the impact that these images of welded steel sculpture by Picasso and Gonzalez had on Smith. So in 1928, he has an issue of the Cahiers d'Art, very important art journal, and he's just flipping through it, and he sees this sculpture. This was actually in the article. And this is Picasso's figure from 1928. It's welded metal and wire. And I'm showing you Julio Gonzalez's sculpture in the center, a woman combing her hair from 1936. And then I'm showing you another Picasso that actually goes along with this one insofar as both of these sculptures initially were thought on Picasso's part, they were going to be part of a funeral monument to the French poet Apollinaire. That never happened. That monument was never completed. But the painting, the sculpture on the far right is called Woman in the Garden from 1929-30. And it's painted. That's interesting. It's painted white. When Smith saw these, especially the one on the far left, he realized that what he knew, metal, iron, steel, and welding, the technique he knew, could be put to a bigger purpose, a more aesthetic, shall we say, purpose. Gonzalez was the most important in the sense that it was Gonzalez who taught Picasso how to weld. Picasso didn't know how to weld. And when he saw Gonzalez's work, he said, gee, I like that. How do you do that? And Gonzalez gave him lessons in welding. Gonzalez himself had associated initially iron with these aggressive ideas, specifically with weaponry, that it could look like weapons. Some of them could be old weapons, spears and things. And then he also associated it with engineering, that it was just structured, that kind of thing. But he didn't think that metal, iron, steel should stay relegated to that place. And then he wrote at one point about that, he said, quote, "It is high time that this metal cease to be a murderer and the simple instrument of an overly mechanical science. Today the door is opened wide to this material to be forged and hammered by the peaceful hands of artists." So he wanted metal to be shifted away from just being this kind of material of war or aggression. And that's something that appealed very much, of course, to David Smith. Now, there are two different ways of welding, two different processes. I'm going to give you a brief, as I've said in the past, some of you know, my father was a welder, so I take this very seriously. Smith knew both processes. So there's arc welding, which is electric. You have an electric current and causes this. That's why they wear the big hood, because there's a big spark when you're welding with the filler rod. And then there's acetylene welding, which doesn't use electricity. It uses a gas, acetylene, and a torch. That's a slightly different process. So here's a guy arc welding on the left. That's not David Smith. So here's the rod that's connected to this little handle that sort of has a little grip, and then that's connected to the source of electricity. When you touch this stick to the metal, it creates that big spark, and this starts to melt down to become the filler in the joining of the metal. So again, I mean, essentially, welding is fusing metal together. Welding's been around since the ancient Greeks. They just did it. They did it differently. And then there is the torch. You don't need to wear this hood. Just protective eyewear. So here's David Smith acetylene welding. Here's the acetylene tank. And here he is with the torch in both cases. Now, believe me, there's an art to it. Somebody who doesn't know how to weld and is just in there whacking around and melting this rod, it looks horrible. You got all this filler that's all over the place. When you look at David Smith's welds, they're meticulous. And he can use welds in different ways. He might want to emphasize, actually, that this is something that I joined to this, or he might not. He might want you to think it was all one thing. So there are different attitudes. Again, it's like a painter, whatever. There are different techniques that can be employed. Now, David Smith was also very much a draftsman. And drawing, remember, he really starts as a painter and then as a draftsman, and then kind of morphs into sculpture. I just want to show you a random selection here. These are all drawings we have at the National Gallery by David Smith, and they represent different times. The earliest one is in the upper left. This is untitled, but it actually has a subtitle called Virgin Islands. He spent a year in the Virgin Islands with his wife from 1933, very Picasso-like. And then down here in the lower left is untitled. That's from 1951. That's a brush drawing with black ink and gouache. On the upper right, these are among his best drawings, where he just does these structural kinds of things. That's an untitled from 1957. And then at the lower right is a late series from the 60s, untitled, but it's all based on the female nude. And technically, I guess that's not a drawing. It's enamel on canvas, so technically I guess we would say that's a painting. At Bolton Landing, he kept two studios. He kept a dirty studio and a clean studio. So the dirty studio was the welding studio, right? And the clean studio was for painting and drawing. And he would draw every night. He would work on sculpture throughout the day, and as soon as he was done for the day, he drew in the at night. Talking about drawings and sculpture, he said at one point, this is in 53, he said, "These drawings are studies for sculpture, sometimes what sculpture is, sometimes what sculpture can never be. Sometimes they are atmospheres from which sculptural form is unconsciously selected during the labor process of producing form." Then again, they may be amorphous, floating, direct statements in which I am the subject and the drawing is the act. They are all statements of my identity and come from the constant work stream. This idea of work stream is very important to Smith. And that's why the idea of series cuts across this kind of intellectual thought. There are many artists in the history of art who had incredibly disciplined work ethics. Rodin comes to mind in the 19th century. But I don't think anybody can approach David Smith's work ethic. This guy was always working. And even when he wasn't literally making something, he was making sculpture in his head. He was thinking about sculpture. He was working on sculpture. He had two children that he was devoted to. They are today the presidents of his estate, Candida and Rebecca Smith. Those were his two daughters. And he was a much older father when he had children. He didn't believe in buying toys. He thought that was just not creative enough. So whenever his children wanted toys, he made the toys. So even in his recreation, he was working. He was thinking. He would make things. His children wanted, when they moved to Bolton Landing, they wanted a horse. And he said, okay, if you can make a full-scale horse, I'll buy you one. And he made an armature. And then they had to make the horse out of plaster of Paris. And they had to study the anatomy of a horse, the musculature of a horse, and they had to make this horse, and they did, and he bought them a horse. So he was always working in one way or another. He was also a printmaker. He makes his first lithographs in the early 50s, 52. This is David Smith's, it's titled A Letter on the Left from 1952. It's a lithograph that's at MoMA. But I'm comparing it to a painting we own at the National Gallery on the right, which is by Adolf Gottlieb. And this is Pictograph from 1942. Smith was very interested in Gottlieb. He was very interested in Gottlieb's paintings. And what he was interested about in Gottlieb was how Gottlieb was creating this kind of pictographic language. He was segregating symbols like hieroglyphics in little boxes so that when you look at the painting, you think, I know I'm supposed to be able to read this, but I don't quite know how to read it. I don't have the key to it, much like reading Finnegan's Wake. I wish I had the thesaurus for it or whatever, the key to it. And this is a letter that's meant to be read across. And it's so intriguing, because you can see little, I think that's like one of his little sculptures, or that's this, or that's that. And to try to decode it, they're like pictographs, they're like hieroglyphics, etc. What was a common source for Gottlieb, as well as for Smith in this, and in fact for most of the New York school, certainly the Surrealists emphasized Freud, but a lot of the New York school emphasized Jung. Pollock was in Jungian analysis, Gottlieb was in Jungian analysis. And so the whole idea of symbols, archetypes, language that's visual, this kind of idea that is evident in Jung, and the whole sort of Joseph Campbell thing, they were interested in that. That's part of what you see going on here. There are a series of later drawings that are distinct from the ones I just showed you, and these are the drawings from the 60s. This is Untitled on the left from 63. And the one on the right is titled DS 1958. DS, of course, are his initials. And it's from 1958. These are the so-called spray drawings. So in the late 50s, what he's now using is commercial aerosol spray paint, which, by the way, had just been invented. He's fascinated by that. And he would take a piece of paper or sometimes a piece of canvas or whatever, and put it on the floor, and then he would cut out from cardboard, or it might be pieces of metal, and he would lay them all down flat, and then he would just spray it. And then he'd lift off those pieces, and essentially he made a stencil. That's basically what we're doing here. He's making a stencil. And these would very often be ways he was working out the formal relationship of what would be a three-dimensional sculpture. He's very interested in breaking down boundaries between and among painting, sculpture, and drawing, that there should be a blurry kind of distinction between and among those. So the drawing on the left is in a private collection today. The one on the right is at the Met in New York. Now, the next series after the medals is directly related to the medals because it's aggressive, it's horrific, it's violent, but it's three-dimensional. So it's like now he looked at the medals and said, remember, the medals are bronze, not welded steel. He looks at the medals and says, okay, I'm going to lift this off, and I'm going to lift this off, and I'm going to start now doing them. There are only five specters. One doesn't even have the word specter in it. The Jurassic bird is a specter, but it's not referred to as a specter. This is the specter of profit on the right from 46. And this is a page from Smith's notebooks, sketchbooks, where he's working on this idea of this carnivorous form. He does away with these little wings eventually, holding this spoon, which is a found object, and which you can't see in the photograph, but you can kind of see it here. What's in the spoon are people who are all bound, and they're about to be dinner for this specter. He's going to eat them. He's going to devour them. Specter of Profit, 1946. So the specters are all created around in the mid-40s, 44, 45, 46 are the years for the specters. And they clearly are, again, addressing Smith's political sensibilities, convictions about war, his leftist kind of idea, the idea of senseless brutality and victimization of war, how very often capitalism profits by war, again, because of making armaments, etc. He said about the specters in 46, he says, quote, for the capitalist conception of man, war becomes the natural condition of selection. So it's like a Darwinian natural selection, but it's based on capitalism, not necessarily on the survival of the fittest. There are often these carnivorous, they seem like prehistoric animals or skeletons. The place he spent a lot of time in this period when he's working on the specters is the New York Museum of Natural History. And he's looking at skeletons, one of which is going to be very important. It's one here. This is actually based on a skeleton that he saw at the Museum of Natural History. This is Jurassic bird from 1945. And this is the false peace specter. The false peace specter from 45. So the specters are, for the most part, they're carnivorous kinds of creatures. They're predatory. This was a bird diving, according to the label in the museum, diving to get prey. So it was a predatory bird. And he likes this juxtaposition between the prehistoric and the modern. I think that's what's evident on the right, because this specter on the right, the false peace specter, it certainly looks like some kind of prehistoric monster or bird form, but it also could be a sort of a plane or some kind of a jet fighter or some kind of a modern image or object of destruction. Here is interesting as well, because that's painted. So we have, and in fact, parts of this he cast. So this work, we have bronze and steel painted blue. So he's already sort of tinkering with the idea of how paint would work with sculpture. And that training as a painter really never leaves him. The ones that I've just shown you are all in private collections today. They're not that big. This is the one that's not in a private collection. This is in the Museum of Fine Arts in Houston. And this is the Specter of War from 1944, one of the first in the series. So he's dealing directly with war. And what he liked, one of the things he likes is this kind of conflation of beauty and horror, which was a very surrealist thing. In other words, you could look at one of these instruments of destruction, a bomb, a missile, whatever, and it's horrible. But then you say, well, boy, it sure has beautiful lines. It's, you know, it's aerodynamic, it's this, it's that. And you start to lose sight of what it actually is supposed to be doing because you just like the shape of it, something like that. So he's trying to also, I won't say he's trying to redeem steel, because steel doesn't have that history, but he's trying to validate steel. And he says about that, quote, possibly steel is so beautiful because of all the movement associated with it, its strength and functions, yet it is also brutal. The rapist, the murderer, the death-dealing giants are also its offspring. So how one chooses to deal with steel, you see all these missile-like forms here, but then you see something that looks like a destructive form. All of these things are part of how, it's what gives the specters their tension when we are trying to get a hold of them. This is the aggressive character from 1947, which is iron and stainless steel, welded iron and stainless steel. It's on a wooden base. This is an important work because it's kind of a transitional work. It certainly speaks back to Giacometti. All of these aggressive points and protuberances, things that you could that could penetrate you or hurt you, or it's, in other words, it's not a sculpture you're going to cuddle up to. It has too many places where you could get hurt by it. It's all stainless steel except for this little pitchfork-like shape here. That's iron. So it has that, and then it does have a kind of play on the title that the surrealist-like titles that could be interpreted in 100 different ways. This isn't that sort of profound, but aggressive character, you could think of it as this guy is an aggressive character, he's a character and he's aggressive. Or you could think of aggressive character, I have an aggressive character, I have an aggressive personality, that idea. So there's a kind of duality there. But it's stainless steel, and the forms are sort of cubic or square, at least this big one, and the one in the back here, except for these appendages. This is interesting because he's now thinking about stainless steel, which is not something he's going to really embrace until later. This is looking, in some ways, I think the sculpture looks in two directions. It's looking back to the Surrealist with all of its aggression, but it might be looking forward to the stainless steel cubi series as well. Again, he talks about art, making art, as he said at the time of this figure, about a year after. The words I use in talking about art do not bear close relationship to making art, nor are they necessary directives or useful explanations. When I work, the train of thought has no words. It is simply all in the visual world. The language is an image. This constant reference to train of thought, stream of consciousness, of it's a continuum. All of this seems to be a very, very important motif. These are two of the most famous, what we might call drawings in space. I showed you Australia earlier from 51. That's the same time as these sculptures. On the left is Star Cage from 1950. On the right is the Hudson River landscape. Arguably, this might be his best known drawing in this regard from 1951. In 1950, just prior to working on these sculptures, he was awarded a Guggenheim Fellowship. And that was a big, important thing, because it gave him enough money to not have to teach for a while. David Smith sold almost nothing in his lifetime, especially the bigger they got, the less they sold. What are you going to do with a 9-foot stainless steel sculpture and put it in your coffee table? Even museums were not buying his work. He has a retrospective at the Guggenheim. They don't buy anything from the exhibition. So he always had to have another job. So he always was welding. He worked in welding plants, and he was always teaching. He taught at Sarah Lawrence College, he taught at Indiana University, he taught at the University of Arkansas. He had visiting professorships, artists in residencies, you know, to try to cobble enough money to continue to live. The Guggenheim gave him some time off. And the series that he began with after the Guggenheim Fellowship are these works here, which are among his most important because they clearly do blur the distinction between certainly drawing and sculpture, because it looks like he's drawing in space again, and how we read the positive and the negative space, all of that. Is this something we're supposed to track? You know, some people think the Hudson River landscape, you're supposed to start at one point and then just kind of keep tracking it. I don't think that's the way it was supposed to work. They really define and they redefine the nature of both sculpture and drawing. What's sometimes not mentioned in the Star Cage, Smith loved the sky. I mean, in Bolton Landing at night when it was dark and he's away from the city, he just saw this incredible array of stars. And so the stars, constellations, all of that was important to him. and that may have a reference here. But what's sometimes not mentioned is that this is probably based on a drawing by his wife. And that always gets lost in the literature. Dorothy Denner was a very important sculptor and painter in her own right. They had met at the Art Students League. And she did a drawing that looks almost exactly like this. And you almost have the sense that when his wife was asleep, he snuck down and looked at what she had done that day. And then he comes up with this sculpture. So I think it is. I don't have an image of that. I wish I did, of the Denner drawing. But it does relate dramatically to that. The Hudson River landscape, here it is at the Royal Academy in London for an exhibition on the New York School. This is Pollock, of course, in the background. And here it is. But this is a photograph on the right of the sculpture taken by David Smith at Bolton Landing. David Smith was also a photographer, and most often he's photographing his own work. And when he sets it out in Bolton Landing, he sets it out with a purpose. He doesn't just throw these things out there willy-nilly. He's thinking about, he curates the landscape, essentially. And then when he takes a picture, he's particularly precise about how he looks at the sculpture through the viewfinder and how he will crop it. We have, I'll show you a contact sheet in a second of a photograph, and you'll see what the photograph was originally and then how he cropped it are very different. So look at how he's very careful to make this go right to the line of the mountains. So this is all against the sky. It's that kind of meticulous care that's very important. The Hudson River landscape may relate to his commuting. He would commute, at this time he was teaching at Sarah Lawrence, and he had been commuting from Bolton Landing to Bronxville, and he would be sitting looking out the window, and this landscape would be rushing by, and that may be sort of vestigial glimpses. That's interesting because that's exactly what the futurists used to do, specifically Umberto Boccioni. Boccioni used to sit on the train, and as everything sped by, of course, they were interested in speed, velocity. He would just make these little notations. About landscape, Smith writes, quote, and this is in 47, he says, "I have never looked at a landscape without seeing other landscapes. I have never seen a landscape without visions of things I desire and despise. A landscape is a still life of Chaldean history. It has faces I do not know. Its mountains are always sobbing females. It is the place I've traveled to and never found." And then at another point, he's asked about why he chooses to live in Bolton Landing. And he says, "I cannot live in New York. I want to live alone and far away. I want to live in nature. And when I live in nature, I have the most idealized concept possible." Now, this open positive, negative, how do we read it as a positive space, a negative space? Is this supposed to be the paper of a drawing? The negative space is the paper of the drawing, that kind of thing. Clearly, again, Giacometti was an influence here because Giacometti had begun to create these open fretwork sculptures that had as much negative space as positive space. This is Giacometti's palace at 4 a.m. in 1932. That's at MoMA. It's a sculpture David Smith, of course, knew. It's one of Giacometti's greatest sculptures. But what's different here is the Giacometti comes directly out of a dream and out of a Freudian connotation. I'm not going to read you this whole thing because it gets really kind of crazy. But this is something he dreams about, a relationship with a woman. We lived in this house. It used to fall apart because it was made of sticks, blah, 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 blah. That's not what David Smith is doing now. He's moved beyond that kind of idea. Now, here you see kind of the way drawing can work. I mean, this is an interesting trio, because you have the steel drawing number one. This is steel, thick plate steel, that he's cut through with a torch. So you're looking at the space, the wall behind it. That's why it looks white. This is at the Hirshhorn, by the way, from 1945. This is a traditional drawing, ink on paper, right? And in fact, this could be a study almost for one of these, because look down here, how it looks like a base. But in any case, this is what we expect. The ink is the positive, the paper is the negative. Here we've got the Hudson River landscape, which reacts like this. The steel is the positive, the open air is the negative. Here, it's just the opposite. So he's playing with these all these ideas of positive, negative space, et cetera, materials, and all of that. Now, probably the first great series, it's not really the Metals and it's not really the Spectre series, but the first great monumental sort of series by David Smith is this one. This is the Agricola series. So this is Agricola number one on the left from 51-52, and Agricola 9 on the right from 52. The one on the left, that's at the Hirshhorn, it's in their sculpture garden. It's been inside, but often now I think it's back outside. And Agricola 9 on the right is at the Tate in London. The Agricola series has 17 sculptures comprise the series. He takes the term Agricola, which is Latin for farmer, and he uses that title for a very specific reason, because the Agricola series is almost completely made of farm implements and tools that he just welds together. So he's taking farm machinery, parts of machinery, wrenches, various kinds of tools. Here, these are all tools. And they almost create, however, a kind of rib cage for an animal in a certain way. They look like a rib cage. Agricola number one on the left, and most of this series in general, already the title Latin title takes you back in time to the Romans, etc. But this is probably his most historical series, the one where he seems to have been thinking a lot about the past and kind of revamping it or reinventing it. So it's the most classical or historical series, probably. Even though he's changing the materials, they're modern materials, they're metal, he's welding, nonetheless, it has that kind of connotation. So when you look at the Agricola on the left, Agricola number one, and especially remembering that he did spend time in Washington, D.C., and he did come to the National Gallery, and he certainly walked through the Rotunda, it does seem like it's maybe a version of the Mercury in a fountain. If you flip this guy around so he's the same direction, it then almost looks like it's a kind of a modern welded steel version of Mercury that we have in our fountain. This is the photograph he took of Agricola 1 at Bolton Landing. So that's a David Smith photograph on the far right. People talk about this relationship. Is that really true? Did he really look at the National Gallery 1? I mean, I don't have any documentary proof for this. He didn't write a letter saying, today I spent the day looking at Mercury, you know, at the National Gallery. But I certainly think he knew the sculpture. I'm one of the art historians who kind of thinks this is probably a good, valid relationship. Some people don't go along with that. Certainly it's different. Obviously it's different. So it is a more hieratic image. It has rigidity. It's frontal. It's thin. It's welded steel. I grant you all of that. But I still think there might be some vestigial kind of connection. I'm only showing you those two from the Agricola series because I want to move on to the next great series, which is the Sentinel series. So remember I mentioned the Sentinels are from 56 to 57. Then he takes a little break, and then he comes back in 61 with Sentinels in stainless steel. But the initial real first ones are not in stainless steel. They're welded and painted steel. And of course, we're fortunate at the National Gallery to have the very first one. So this is number one, that's in our collection. That's upstairs in the fourth floor, the upper level of the East Building in the Abstract Expressionist Room. This is Sentinel number one from 1956 by David Smith. This is Sentinel number three from 57. This one is at the National Gallery, and this is in a private collection today on the right. This is a photograph by David Smith. So he took that photograph on the right. This is probably the series that has the greatest variety within the series. The Sentinels have a certain variation. Sometimes you wouldn't think that that was part of the same series, so they show a lot of variety. But these are also about, again, basic sculptural ideas. They're about, especially about balance and counterbalance, what in essence we would call in the classical sense, contrapposto. When you move one way, another part of your body has to move another way, otherwise you're going to fall over. That kind of idea. They are closed forms, they're thin, they're vertical. These works he places straight on the ground, no pedestals. They have a relationship to the human body. If you go up to the East Building and stand next to this, it's going to be taller than you, but not to the point where you're going to feel sort of intimidated. by it. I love little things like this. Because it's like, you know, you stand and then you kick your leg that way. It's really, the way he's using curved and counter-curve, eventually this is going to feed into concave and convex, but here it's just curve and counter-curve. He titles them sentinels because when at Bolton Landing, he put them on high outcrops of land because they were lookouts, they're sentinels. They're supposed to be looking out at the landscape for any danger that might be coming. And they can either look like they're just sentinels like that, or they have certain abilities to warn us with flags or something like, okay, trouble coming, and they can flap their flags sort of to tell us about trouble. I mean, here I do think he's thinking about sculpture going all the way back to the ancient Greeks. He's thinking about, this is the Kouros figure that's at the Met that he would have seen a million times, the Metropolitan Kouros from archaic Greek sculpture. The sentinels are closed, they're rather severe, they're controlled, they're monolithic, all of this kind of idea. They have a human dimension, they're dealing with certain ideas about stability. All of that is the case. There is this question always about whether he was making, some people ask interesting questions, but people used to ask him, are your sculptures boys or girls? And he said emphatically, I don't make boy sculptures. They become kind of personages, and sometimes they cry out to me that I should have been better or bigger. In other words, they're saying to him, gee, I wish you had made me bigger or better. And mostly they tell me that I should have done that 12 years before or 20 years before. In other words, they're chastising him. Why didn't you come up with this idea 20 years ago? That kind of idea. That's interesting because certainly there is a very, very personal psychological connection between David Smith and these sculptures. And the fact that he puts them at Bolton Landing, that they populate his landscape, that he sits every day and looks at them, that he moves them, he picks them up and takes them places, he'll take them to the lake, then he'll bring them back, all this sort of stuff. And especially after the death of his second wife, not the death, their divorce, he still lives for another 4 or 5 years, but now he's by himself up at Bolton Landing. He's a bachelor. He doesn't get to see his children as often as he would like. And this personal connection to these sculptures, I think, is very, very profound. Almost, he repeatedly calls them personages. He doesn't call them people, but he does call them personages. So that's an interesting thing that we'll look at as we go along, and that relates to the way he places them throughout Bolton Landing. So here is one of the fields at Bolton Landing photographed by David Smith in 1958. We can identify all of these sculptures. Some are in private collections, some are in museums. This is our sculpture. So this is the one today in the National Gallery. Here, others, one's in the Whitney, others are in private collections, etc. And that takes us to this series, and this is the Tank Totem. That's all one word, T-A-N-K-T-O-T-E-M, Tank Totem series. There are 10 sculptures in this series, and these are two, Tank Totem 3 on the left from 1953, which is in a private collection, and Tank Totem number 4 on the right from 53, that's today at the Albright Knox in Buffalo. He begins the series in 1952, and this is somewhat of a breakthrough, I think, series for David Smith. He dispenses with the pedestals again, as we had already in the Sentinels. They're right on the ground, but now they often stand on legs. They now often have a very distinct reference to human figures that could walk or move, so they emphasize verticality. They seem to almost have personality. This is actually the time when he was very conscientious about starting to arrange these things out in his fields. So these played a role in that. They hover somewhere between abstraction and figuration. Tank Totem refers to a couple of things. He's now taking steel boilers or water tanks, and he's cutting them. And especially the end of the tank, that's the curved part. When he cuts the tank with a torch, he gets this kind of concave circle. that he now is using to as part of the sculpture. The totem part, tank totem, of course, refers to the idea that these, in his mind, are totemic figures, like totem poles in the Pacific Northwest or in other non-Western traditions, these tribal ritualistic totems that people worshipped or that had some kind of animate, religious, mystical kind of connotation. I'll come back to these guys, but here are sketches for the tank totems. The one on the left is still owned by the estate of David Smith. It's from 1952. It's tempera in ink on paper. The one on the right is at MoMA. It's from 53. It's gouache in ink on paper. So there are two important sources here, and I've kind of alluded to them already. The first are primitive totems and their symbols, especially in non-Western culture, but even in the Pacific Northwest culture of the totem pole, the Haida, the Tlingit, all these various tribes. So there's that. But the totem thing also relates to something else, and it relates to Freud. And it relates to Freud's book, Totem and Taboo, which was written in 1913, translated widely. He read Freud's Totem and Taboo, and what he was impressed with by what Freud was talking about in that book is that a totem has a dual nature. Part of the nature is as an object of desire. We desire this totem. It's going to do something for us. So we have desire with the totem, but it's also prohibited. It's taboo. It's a totem and it's a taboo. So it creates a tension, a stress, a dichotomy, a friction. And for Freud, and Smith simply believed this himself, this totem and taboo idea, attraction, repulsion, desire, prohibition, was the plight of modern society in terms of sex and sexuality. Going back to the surrealists, this idea that in modern sexuality, these were constraints that were placed on society that often harbored bad results. He talks about, again, at this time, he says, "My concept of an artist is a revolt against the well-worn beauties in the form of a statue. Rather, I would prefer my assemblages to be the savage idols of basic patterns, the veiled directives, subconscious associations, the image recall of orders more true than the object itself, resulting in vision, in aura, rather than object reality." So he's speaking to that idea here as well. Now, here are the two that I've just shown you, if you remember back here. But now, this, by the way, was a photograph by David Smith that is at Bolton Landing. But now I want to show you this. This is a photograph by David Smith of two of the tank totems, the ones I just showed you, this one and this one. The little guy in the middle is not a tank totem. That's a sculpture that just goes by a date. Its name is a date, and the date is 7-29-53. And obviously it was done in 1953. Here's where he takes the tank, and this is a photograph by David Smith. Here's where he takes the tank totems out of the field and brings them down to the lake. We're gonna go swimming. Everybody, it's gonna be a picnic. He takes them all down to the dock, and notice he puts this little guy on a pallet here, so he's a little bit elevated. So he started to do this in 1953. He starts bringing these guys down to the lake and photographing them. And then he sets them up in different ways. So, oh, here, by the way, is where this guy resides today. I told you where these guys are, private collection in Buffalo. This guy is in Germany today. he's at the Ludwig Museum in Cologne. These are two paintings, Jackson Pollock and Lee Krasner. This Pollock painting, Unformed Figures, the same year as this, 53. This Krasner painting is later, from 1980. But here are the figures in different configuration. Now he's kind of running them together on an angle, right? They overlap a bit. But look at how he turns this guy. So now that square part is like a viewfinder looking to the landscape back here, right? This is great because he brings in this little guy who looks like he just crawled out of the water. And then he shifts the positions again of these three figures. But the one that's most interesting is this guy, this tank totem here, because he's walking now. He looks like he's walking to the edge. These figures, by the way, if you read them, this little guy is called Bicycle, Bi-cycle, from 53. Then there's the one we just talked about that has the date. Then number four, and then over here is number three. Here's the contact sheet. Here's that photograph. Notice how much space there is here? So that between the contact sheet and this, he crops it. And that makes it look even more like it's going to walk right out of the painting and fall into the water, that kind of thing. The way he now is thinking of these sculptures really is like they are anthropomorphic. They're figures, you know, we're all going to go down today and have a day on the dock by the beach. And you can see similar adjustments through all of these contact sheets. This is tank totem number 9. This one today is at Storm King in Mountainville, New York. They have 14 David Smiths. So this is number 9 from 1960. It's steel that's painted white. And then we have legs that are painted either orange or red. The paint is sort of changing. And black and blue down here. So this is the same thing. It looks like it's kind of standing on legs. This is the photograph Smith took of tank totem number 9 at Bolton Landing. Here he sliced the boiler tank, then cut it. So this was a circle originally, the end of a tank. He cuts the tank, then he cuts it in half, and then he places the concave part towards us. So it looks almost like it's smiling. And what's interesting here is that he paints this. This is painted white, and then these other colors that are on the legs. Here he is working on it. So here he is in his studio at Bolton Landing, working on tank totem number 9. And here it is again, photographed in the winter with two of its compatriots. In the back, there are two other tank totems, number 7 and number 8, all from 1960. So by this time, this question about series is constantly kind of dogging him. And there was an interview in 62 where the interviewer says, well, where Smith has said in the course of the interview, "I never think of my series as variations on a theme. That's not in my lexicon." And then the interviewer says, "Well, if they're not variations on a theme, what are they?" And then Smith says, "They're continuous parts of my concept." So this is a continual flow of things. That's how he answered that question in 1962. I'm going to go ahead and stop with the next great series, which is this one. This is the Zig series, Z-I-G. But we'll talk about that next time if you come for part two. Thanks very much.
This has been a National Gallery of Art podcast.